Thank you, Winston Elliott, and ladies and gentlemen, and members of the Philadelphia Society, and friends of freedom. I have a small bit of housekeeping here that you may wish to be made aware of. Excuse me. I have written a fairly lengthy paper about REPCA, of which, because of the time constraints here, I can only offer you a few juicy extracts. However, I want to say that should anyone wish to have the full text, please see me here now, afterwards, that is, and I'll give you my business card, and you can request a copy by mail, as well as any other items that you may be interested in that I left on the table. Wilhelm Repke entered my life with immense effect on me more than 50 years ago. And that was a time in which the political and intellectual climate was rather different than today. The world was just beginning to rise from the ashes of the greatest war, World War II. Socialism was everywhere in the ascendant. The Soviet colossus bestrode half the planet. China was soon to become a monolithic communist state, and the United States stood virtually alone, if we accept Switzerland, as a guardian of the market economy. Who could then have foreseen that in 1998, the Soviet Empire would be no more, that a united Germany would have arisen like a phoenix from the ashes, to become the economic powerhouse of Europe, and that socialism and planned economy, in quotation marks, would become derisory, even pejorative terms, except maybe in Cuba, and that expressions such as social market economy, third way, and humane economy would become the fashionable slogans of the moment. But that is today. And to understand today, we need to go back to yesterday, quite a few yesterdays, in fact. It was exactly 52 years ago. Am I that old? In this very month of October, 1946, that I first encountered Wilhelm Repke. The setting of that encounter has remained with me, a crisp fall day in Geneva, in a handsome chateau housing the Graduate Institute of International Studies. On the shores of Lake Geneva, and in the distance across the lake, the majestic white cone of Mont Blanc, faintly visible through the morning haze. In the classroom, a group of some 30 students waited expectantly. As I recall, they included half a dozen young ladies from Smith College, all lined up in the front row, and all but one, remarkably, writing, as I do, with the left hand, a circumstance that confounded the non-Americans in the room. Even in free Switzerland, I discovered, left-handedness is regarded as an affliction, best extirpated in a child's earliest years. Do you mean that in America they actually let you write the wrong way when you were a child? Was the inveterate refrain that was heard. But if my handedness was left and genetic, my ideological sympathies were moderately rightward and self-chosen. I was ready for Repke, of whom it was bruited about in the school, he's the most conservative professor in the place. On the other hand, Repke's name, other than his general political orientation, meant little to me. His major works were not yet available in English, and also economics was not yet my discipline. I had come to Geneva fresh from Columbia University, where I had received a master's degree from the School of Journalism. My prior academic work was in a Jesuit university in languages, the arts, history, and philosophy. Economics and business were subjects that we sort of looked down upon at Fordham. I mean, that was for the football players. And I didn't really care for these subjects very much. But anyway, here I was, pursuing a degree in political science in Repke's classroom at the suggestion of a friend. That is to say, more or less by accident. As I think back on that first encounter, on what became for me a life-altering event, I was prepared to be informed, possibly entertained, perhaps bored. I was not prepared to be put under a spell, as was the case when Repke strode into the classroom. A man in his middle 40s, of medium height and build, with a handsome leonine head and sandy hair, ruddy complexion, blue eyes that burned with some inner fire, but free of any hint of fanaticism, a voice of heavy timbre, and somewhat louder than normal due to a chronic condition of deafness. And finally, Repke's signature trait, craggy brows shading the intent eyes. His lecture was in English, which he used with sensitivity and precision. His text was rich with literary and historical allusion, a verse from Goethe, a maxim from Montaigne, a quip from Shakespeare, or apt quotations from a de Tocqueville, Jacob Burckhardt, Edmund Burke, Benjamin Constant, or Adam Smith. And even after all these years, I still see that man, I still feel the intensity and the power of his thought and of his presentation, which combined passion with a wit that was sometimes mordant, never wounding, I would add, of another person, but always precisely on point. The finely honed humor of the man was infectious, keeping his hearer's lips slightly curled in anticipatory merriment. Particularly amusing was the manner in which Repke employed his hearing handicap to manage the discussion. In those years, his seminars, conducted around a long table, occasionally drew a couple of socialists who came not so much to learn as to heckle him. For the most part, these naysayers were silenced by rapier thrusts of Repkean wit, which, though gracefully delivered and shedding little or no blood, left the antagonists, nevertheless, squirming and red-faced. Rarely did things turn obnoxious. But when they did, Repke resorted to his secret weapon, a volume control concealed on his belt for his hearing aid. And when the hostile voices reached a certain level of stridency, a slight movement of Repke's left shoulder indicated to me that he was tuning them out and that it was time for me to raise my hand to pose a question. "Yes, Mr. Borman," he would say brightly. The slight movement of his shoulder indicating that he was now turning the volume control back up. Anyhow, notwithstanding such divertissement, learning from Repke in the seminar format was like taking part in a totally absorbing mystery play, interactive mystery play with the students hanging on every word. In short, in those lectures and seminars long ago, William Repke snared my soul, so to speak. I determined then and there to change my focus and to become an economist. And although Repke was probably the most distinguished professor at the university at that time, he was always accessible, or at least I found him so. In those first years after the war, automobiles were rarities in Geneva. Bicycles filled the streets, and often Repke and I would ride our bikes home together from the Institute. I was a frequent visitor in his home. Then, and some years later, when, as a married man with three children, and of course a wife, I returned to Geneva to finish my doctoral dissertation. Evening at the Repkes, where his wife Eva presided as hostess, and which might include prominent personages that were visiting, a Ludwig Erhard, a Friedrich Hayek, a Walter Eucken, were a genuine delight. At these evening gatherings, Repke showed himself to be a gifted raconteur who could appreciate and tell a good joke. pompous personages, academic and other, were nicely deflated with barbed but good-humored comment as the wine flowed, after which the talk turned solemn and sometimes portentous. To this young and impressionable would-be economist, me, participating in a Repke soiree was, in the language that my children now use, a totally awesome experience. Repke's scholarly output was even then phenomenal, but given the academic demands a graduate student was under, it was possible only to sample a few of his books. There was one in which, as a neophyte economist, I was particularly interested, his basic economics textbook, not yet translated into English. Great was my rejoicing when I found in the Institute's library a French version of that book, Explication économique du monde moderne. I read it virtually at one sitting, finding it to be not only a splendid layman's introduction to the arcane science of economics, but an eloquent anti-totalitarian tract as well. I determined then and there to translate the book into English, an ambition which was eventually realized. And there was another reason for my gratification at having come upon this book. The reading of it was a liberating experience, for it showed a way around through the frozen dialogue between the adherents of old-style capitalism on the one hand and of a government-run economy on the other, to which much of the discourse among academicians at that time seemed to reduce. In this textbook, Repke argued for the rejection of socialism and the reconstitution of the market economy as the only economic system compatible with human freedom. The market economy, however, for which he pleaded, differed fundamentally from the system which, under the vague and emotion-charged label of capitalism, had persisted in Europe until the 1930s and then perished of its own degeneracies. Capitalism was, for Repke, a highly imprecise noun freighted with the ideological ballast of the 19th century, which gave birth to the term, and carrying with it, even today, the value tags, positive or negative, of whomever happens to be defining it. In contrast, the market economy, at its core and unencumbered with labels from right or left, the market economy was for him a term, a neutral term in that sense, embracing those universal human behaviors associated with acquiring and using economic resources and famously codified in the laws of supply and demand. Indiscriminate mixing of the concept of a market economy with capitalism results in the attribution of qualities to the market mechanism that properly are only ascribable to some specific capitalist societies of the past, notably those of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Thus, the market economy that was installed in West Germany after World War II, and which the Germans chose to call a social market economy, represented a deliberate attempt to divorce the market idea from historical capitalism. And the lasting achievement of Ludwig Erhard, Repke's friend, was his abstraction of this immensely powerful concept of the market from the institutional matrix of 19th century capitalism in which it was embedded, and his demonstration that the market can yield a quite different result within a different institutional framework. The social market economy itself derived from one of Repke's most fruitful conceptions, that of the third road. In his numerous elaborations of this idea, he showed how the old antitheses of laissez-faire and planned economy could be transcended in a new synthesis of what he called the third road, later rebaptized as a humane economy. In such an economy, the laws of supply and demand, while allowed full play to maximize the wealth of the nation, were yet constrained within a framework of market-conforming rules, among the most important of which were those intended to preserve competition, but many others as well. For the absence of such rules, the benevolent social outcomes of the pursuit by individuals of their own self-interest which was posited by the classical economists, are extinguished, the market becomes an arena for a dog-eat-dog struggle, a thesis for which Russia today furnishes the unhappy proof. It is striking that for all the many years that the concept of the third road or the third way has been imprinting itself on policy, especially in Germany, but in other places in Europe as well, we are just, thanks to Repke, we are just now hearing about it in this country in the most influential circles. In the New Yorker of July 6th, just passed this year, we are told that Larry Summers, Clinton's potent deputy treasury secretary, is, quote, the leading intellectual exponent of the third way, a nascent and occasionally derided political philosophy associated with the names of both Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, its central notion being how to reconcile the free market with the social conscience. Even the First Lady has been reported by the New York Times as being engaged with scholars and bankers in mapping a third way between historical laissez-faire capitalism and the welfare state. Amazingly, we are told in this same report, the same New York Times report, that Mr. Clinton, or at least Mr. Clinton B.M., that is, before Monica, quote, was the man who could break the ideological deadlock of left and right, for no one, we are breathlessly informed, had yet coined the phrase the third way. One is entitled to speculate whether the real third way Mr. Clinton is after is some kind of safe passage between Monica Lewinsky and Kenneth Starr on the one hand and the House Judiciary Committee on the other. We can only imagine Wilhelm Repke's consternation at all this, were he to know of it, and perhaps he does. One might ask, what is this third way to do, for example, with the famed middle way of Sweden? And the answer, of course, is virtually nothing. Thus, Sweden's overall public spending is today, listen to this now, 63% of gross national product, compared to about 36% for the United States, yes, we're that low, and 46% for Germany. The Swedish government spends 46% of Sweden's GNP on welfare alone, more than any other country. And the income taxes required to support this gargantuan public generosity take 59% of the pay of people earning as little as $30,000 a year. This is a middle way, or third way, if you want to call it that, which has led Sweden into a swamp of rising unemployment, social spending on a megalomaniacal scale, and precipitate falls in its competitiveness and standard of living. They're now, according to the OECD, which is the organization in Paris that monitors this stuff, Sweden has fallen from 4th to 15th place in per capita income. Now, all of this has nothing to do with Repke's third way. Indeed, he was a fierce opponent of the welfare state in the form it had taken in his last years, that would be the mid-1960s, precisely in such places as Sweden and Great Britain, the United States, and especially in his native Germany. The quest for security through welfareism and through a continued expansion of the public sector, in which the state is looked upon, and this was one of Repke's favorite analogies, where the state is looked upon as a kind of a fourth dimension, able to satisfy the demands of any class for help. Repke held that to be an illusion. But again, in keeping with his commitment to what he called, in one of his most characteristic books, Maß und Mitte, Measure and Moderation, his commitment to the avoidance of extremes, Repke wrote censoriously of the delusions of an unrestrained capitalism, of an obsessive economism in which human society was led ineluctably toward a soulless mechanization and standardization, and he pleaded incessantly for the adoption of measures aimed at reducing the crowdedness and the hothouse atmosphere of modern life. In this context, he was a strong proponent of population controls, decentralization of industry, and the securing of the remnants of a rural way of life against erosion. In particular, Repka saw the unrestrained growth of population as helping to spawn the psychic and spiritual toxins afflicting the contemporary culture. He conceded that the power of modern technology has enabled living standards to increase along with the growth of population. But he argued that living standards in the broadest sense, including many non-material dimensions of the good life, would have risen even faster if population growth had slowed. And he posed the plaintive question, and I quote, "Why is it necessary that every enlargement of economic room which is achieved by the labors and the ingenuity of the existing population be immediately filled by millions of new individuals instead of serving to increase the well-being of those now on Earth?" In this sense, way back then, Repka was an environmentalist before the term had been invented. In today's lexicon, he would appear as a slow grower. For him, it was not a matter of turning the clock back, a fatuous romanticism which he repudiated. But for him, it was a matter of refusing to continue heedlessly along the path that had brought us to our present vexation. Anyway, the years passed, in the course of which my relationship with Repka deepened. We communicated often and at length about the issues that tormented the world of the 1960s, the welfare state and its handmaiden, inflation and their attendant miseries, the pursuit of what he saw as a baleful new bureaucratic order in Europe under the rubric of a common market, the enduring power of the communist myth, and the danger of an open conflict with the Soviet Union. In the United States, he appeared with some frequency in my and others' translations in the Wall Street Journal, Modern Age, Social Order, National Review, and other newspapers and journals, while essays and books continued to stream from his pen in German, with translations into French, Italian, Japanese, Swedish, and Finnish, and so on, quickly following. Came the year 1965. A red letter year for me, for in that year Repke extended to me an urgent invitation to come to Geneva as a visiting professor at the Graduate Institute of International Studies with the intention that I should succeed him in his chair there. This was a compliment in which I, of course, could think of none higher. Also in that year, my doctoral dissertation, A Study of the German Economy Done Under Repke's Guidance, was published. I accepted Repke's invitation with the understanding that it would be an experimental undertaking. Initially for 1 year, I had a fully Americanized family to consider and transplanted myself with my wife, my four small children, and my books to Geneva. What a joy and a privilege it was to work alongside my great teacher, now my colleague, a man whom I had always addressed as professor, and who now beseeched me to skip this formality and to call him simply Repka. We visited often with Repka and his wife, Eva. They were fond of my children. This close acquaintance emphatically confirmed my previous impression of him as a true gentleman, generous to a fault to his rivals and opponents, of whom there were many, with never a hint of the odium academicum that infects so much of university life at Geneva and elsewhere. And I greatly enjoyed my teaching duties at the Institute. Then came that Saturday morning in February 1966 when, for a reason I have now forgotten, I drove to the Institute. It was a crisp, wintry day. The refurbished chateau on the shores of Lake Geneva housing the Institute was open for students who wanted to use the library. The trees on the ground were bare of flowers, imparting to the place a mournful aspect, as I recall. There was a thin haze on the lake, but one could see the glistening peak of Mont Blanc in the distance. I mounted the steps and saw that some students had gathered at the door. There were murmurs, and I heard the name Repka. They looked at me, their faces were ashen, some tear-stained, and I knew that Wilhelm Repka, doughty champion of liberty and human dignity, was dead. His obsequies were attended by leading scholars, and messages came from heads of state from a half a dozen European nations. And from the little church in Coligny, not far from his beautiful home on the shores of Lake Geneva, where the funeral services were held, we, several hundred of us, students, friends, and colleagues, followed his bier, banked high with flowers, through the narrow village streets to the cemetery where he was laid to rest, requiescat in pace. I think it's important to note that when Wilhelm Röpke died on February 12, 1966, in his 67th year at his home in Geneva, in the flood tide of his powers, full of honors, and with a veritable mountain of achievement behind him, his bibliography then comprised over 900 items, including some 20 books. This calamitous event was noted on the front pages of virtually every major newspaper in Western Europe. Had there been a Nobel Prize for economics during his lifetime, it was a first awarded in 1969, he surely would have been a strong contender for it. And for many days thereafter, Röpke's life and works were the subject of extensive comment and analysis, not alone in the professional economic circles, but in the popular media. In contrast, in the United States, his passing went practically unnoticed, though the New York Times did manage to squeeze in a reference to it in four lines way in the back of the paper as follows. Professor Wilhelm Röpke, a German economist and sociologist, died suddenly in Geneva yesterday following a heart attack, his family said. He was a former advisor to the German government and author of many books on economic subjects, close quotes. Worse, in another report of the death, a conservative columnist in a Midwestern newspaper, otherwise admiring of Röpke and his work, referred to him as this relatively obscure man. And elsewhere, there was silence as well. But this was simply reflecting an unfortunate fact. Though famous in Europe, and Japan for that matter, and with his name now being heard in China today, Röpke was and is still not known in the United States by any but a few specialists, including you attending this meeting, and the more is the pity. As late as 1996, the situation had not changed. During the presidential campaign of that year, audiences were startled to hear from one of the Republican candidates impassioned denunciations of heartless employers and greedy corporations that were exporting American jobs overseas in search of profit. Such rhetoric had normally come from ultra-liberal Democrats. The candidate in this case was, you guessed it, Pat Buchanan. Where did Pat Buchanan claim to get his economic ideas? When Time magazine posed this question to him, he answered Wilhelm Röpke, whom Time then described as an obscure German economist who died in 1966. It is to Buchanan's credit that he displayed a more accurate awareness of Röpke's real stature than the Time reporter. Doubtless, too, Buchanan saw in Röpke's philosophy of the Third Road a worthy exemplar for the United States. More wrong facts, in any case, appeared just this year in Buchanan's book, The Great Betrayal, in which, and apart from misspelling Röpke's name, he again claims intellectual kinship with Röpke, though his book is an aggressively protectionist tract at odds with everything Röpke believed and taught concerning the international economy. Compounding the misinformation was a lengthy review of Buchanan's book in the New York Review of Books, current issue, which misidentifies Röpke as an Austrian economist. In any case, to Röpke, Buchananite xenophobia and economic autarky would have been simply anathema. A principal reason, in my opinion, in accounting for the American ignorance of and relative disinterest in Röpke is that his Weltanschauung, his total conception of economy, society, and human destiny, has found relatively little echo among those in this country who could be presumed to be his closest ideological supporters. Among the latter, a few of them giants in their own right, will be found those who are straightforward, unapologetic supporters of what might loosely be called laissez-faire economy. But as noted, one of Röpke's major contributions has been to show the threat posed to the very survival of a free economy by a policy of laissez-faire. And also there's room for doubt whether Röpke's frequent denunciation of industrial giantism, of the cult of the colossal and of the super colossal, in short, of monopolism in all its forms, has earned him many points with another segment of the American public that might logically be expected to support his ideas, the business community. Consider, for instance, this statement from Economics of the Free Society, and I quote, "Our economic system stands or falls with competition, since only competition can tame the torrent of private interests and transform them into a force for good. The conclusion can no longer be avoided that the growth of monopoly represents an extremely serious disfigurement of our economic system. To effectively fight monopoly, it is necessary to have a strong state, impartial and powerful, standing above the melee of economic interests, quite contrary to the widely held view that capitalism can thrive only where there is a weak government. The state, unmoved by ideologies of whatever brand, must clearly recognize its task to defend capitalism against the capitalists." Again, those American conservative economists whose escutcheons bear the maxim, "government is the problem, not the solution," will not be enthused by Repka's approach to the role of government in the market economy. In his view of the functions of government, Repka had much in common with his great predecessor, Adam Smith. Like Repka, Smith was an exceptionally harsh critic in his time of individuals and groups whose interests collided with the general welfare, and Smith also argued in consequence for a strong state to ensure that the two converged. In particular, he worried about the fragility of competition, noting in a famous line, and I quote, Smith, quoting Smith, "People of the same trade seldom meet together even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices." How contemporary that sounds. Would Smith have approved such governmental interventions as the antitrust laws? I believe he assuredly would have. Certainly, Wilhelm Repka did, approvingly and frequently citing the American Sherman and Clayton Acts as examples for all market economies to follow. I venture to say that Repka, while he would have been admiring of the entrepreneurial spirit of Bill Gates, would also have been solidly in the corner of the U.S. government in its current efforts to rein in Gates and his behemoth Microsoft Corporation. Parenthetically, Germany's own antitrust law, enacted in 1958, a first of its kind, was modeled after the U.S. law and became known as the Little Sherman Act. I think I'm running a little tight on time. Am I? Yes. All right, I'm coming quickly to the end, so bear with me. Here is Repke's prescription for government, in his words, pardon me. Quote, "A market economy and our economic program presuppose the following type of state. A state which knows exactly where to draw the line between what does and what does not concern it, which prevails in the sphere assigned to it with the whole force of its authority, but refrains from all interference outside this sphere. An energetic umpire, whose task it is neither to take part in the game nor to prescribe their movements to the players, who is rather completely impartial and incorruptible and sees to it that the rules of the game are strictly observed. This is the state without which a genuine and real market economy cannot exist. Benjamin Constant envisaged it when he wrote the words, le gouvernement en dehors de sa sphère ne doit aucun pouvoir dans sa sphère. Il ne saurait en avoir trop. Outside of its proper sphere, the government should have no power. Within its sphere, it cannot have too much." I think I'm going to come to my peroration, and I'd like to close with a brief passage from one of Repka's last letters to his sister, Greta Vilgerot, dated April 1, 1965, less than a year before his death. It's a letter that displays, among other things, his passion for gardening. "My dear Greta, when I rest, I feel exceptionally well, and recently I've been sleeping quite soundly. Rest is what my two doctors have prescribed as the most important medicine. no physical exertion, and no psychic stress. Conclusion, no more trips, he was a great traveler, no more trips, neither to Rome, nor as we were hoping to manage as a substitute, even to southern Germany, or even to Zurich. The business of being confined to Colonie, the little village where they lived on the lake, is not at all cause for disappointment. We have discovered a new formula for happiness. To plan a trip and then to stay home, where it's so beautiful. At this very moment, there's all kinds of things to be taken care of in the garden. Hyacinth, tulips, narcissus, scilla, arabis, crocuses, of course, anemone. Everything is already blooming, and Rebus sanguinea and forsythia will soon be sprouting buds. The lawn awaits its first mowing. In that massacre will be caught up, regretfully, dandelion and similar inferior species, ! It's time for the first seeding, and so on. I must clean out the pond, drain it to the bottom, and in the process speak nicely to the fishes so that they understand that I only mean them well. Watching them dart about in the water so merrily, I have the feeling that they've understood that a guardian angel has watched over them. Are we not really like these fishes? That's the end of the letter. In tandem with it, it's worth noting that Voltaire's famous aphorism, "Il faut cultiver notre jardin," was one of Repke's favorites. It appears often in his writings and illumines his two deepest attachments. On the one hand, to home and hearth, to all that is made to the measure of man. He did several times visit Repke in his home in Geneva. And I remember that one of the very first things that I heard in Repke's classroom was his lavish praise of The Road to Serfdom, which had just been published the year before in London in English. And Repke's wife, this is not widely known, Repke's wife, Eva, translated Hayek's Road to Serfdom from English into German. They were close. I think that although Hayek did accord great importance to the juridical framework of the economy, I'm not sure that he would have gone as far as Repke did in emphasizing the influence of other institutions, including, for example, religion. And so in that sense, and he would not certainly have gone, I think, so far as Repke did in seeing that government had a very important and specific role to I won't say manage the economy, but to influence the evolution of the economy. One could go on with other differences, but they were still, as I say, very close. They were brothers in arms, I would say. I would say they were much closer in that sense to each other than, for example, Repke was to von Mises, for example. Yes?
How did Repke think that a government or government as umpire, as the neutral observer, or in some sense, I suppose, a manager, how could it be created and maintained in that way?
Well, there was a lot of wishful things involved here. In other words, we hope that whoever is in the government is going to be good, and they're going to be incorruptible, and they're going to be this and that. But Repke also recognized, and he used to quote Pascal's famous phrase that human beings, the être humain, est ni ange ni bête, is neither angel nor beast. And if you try to make him an angel, he generally turns into a beast. He was aware of that. He wanted to, and very pragmatic, but he was very strongly persuaded of the notion that just as you need traffic lights to regulate the traffic, since two bodies cannot occupy the same space at the same time, you also need those rules in the economy. The game must be played according to the rules. It's very interesting about his view of rules. He has an analogy which I found very compelling at the time, and I still think it is. He said there's two kinds of interventions by government in the economy. One is what he called non-conformable. That is something that gets right into the market mechanism and screws it up and prevents it from doing its job, such as price control, which prevents the law of supply and demand from working. And he called that something to be avoided. A conformable invention, which, intervention, would be one that seeks to simply add data without monkeying around with a mechanism. For example, every time the government imposes a tax, you see, that is a conformable intervention. It doesn't get into the market and mess around with it. However, he added, he said, well, but we must remember that, and he used the analogy of alcohol. He said, there's two kinds of alcohol, methyl, which is poisonous. You never want to drink that stuff. And ethyl, which is the substance that really is at the foundation of great wines, for example. We don't want to deny ourselves that. So we will indulge in ethyl alcohol. But even there, we've got to be careful we don't overdo it, because that road could lead to sickness and even death. And so too with these conformable interventions that do conform, beware of those. Let's not get drunk on these things, would be his notion. So I thought that was a very helpful analogy. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Borman. We're going to begin the next session at 2:10.